Chapter 5. Ice and Fire. Grey wolf light filters through trunks as the autumn dawn curls round acorns. Warm fur fluffs against the chill, and the macaques' tawny bodies unfurl to reveal snug youngsters sheltered from the dew. Their morning cacophony interrupts the magpie chatter and jay screeches that thread through this forest, ablaze with ember colours. The limestone bluff it blankets is home, yet birds and monkeys alike are wary of the rock shelter. Rich pickings can be found, but danger also hides. Braver individuals drop towards the overhang's shadows. They know the panther is not here because the people are, or were yesterday. The smoke has gone stale. Opportunists, the macaques greedily suck gristly leavings and marrow scraps lacing bone splinters. Sounds float from the mist bowl valley below. Crashing and deep rumbles mark elephants moving to the river. Faint cronking drifts down from a circling crane cyclone high overhead. Above their spiral, higher than mountains, a flock of winter thrushes travels west, seeking berry-laden woods across the sea. Many hours flying later, they reach an island that will one day be famed for its bone-white southern cliffs. But this land belongs, for now, to the beasts. The thrushes alight among trees galleried along the land's greatest river. Tan waters run thick and slow around belligerently peering periscope eyes. Water cascades off a grey bulk rising like a barrel-bodied submarine, and as it chews, surveying the water, the hippopotamus's ears flick. Beyond charging distance, water buffalo loiter in the muds, weed hanging from crescent horns adorned by egrets. They ignore the lion, hunkered down on the high bank, waiting for the rising sun to sear away the fog, just as the fallow deer take the chance for a morning draught. Nowhere on this river, nor anywhere on the island its tributaries drain, does wood smoke wreathe the dawn air. An unimaginably far time in the future, winter thrushes gather once more, and golden morning light again gilds the great river. But its spreading reach is now squeezed by a great city, bridges spanning the water like corset stays. The lions have become immobile, mute on massive plinths. Before them are arrayed not herds, but a massed multicoloured crowd flowing against nudging traffic. Below the statues and the tumult, lost streams thread through the urban rhizome of wires, drains and tunnels. Behold the stony sepulchre of before London, a city reclining on vast gravel beds, packed down and padded by rotted black-brown dirt. Here lie graveyards of entire vanished worlds, speckled by massive bones, shot through with muddy tatters of long-dead flowers, studded with still iridescent beetle wings. In 21st century Europe, the raw stares of giant beasts are mostly filtered through glass and bars. Thameside watering holes are crowded by Westminster politicians, the banks of the once sprawling river last brindled by megafauna tracts, more than 2 millennia ago. London's lions today are moulded in bronze and sport bouffant manes that their predecessors lacked. Its hippos swim in concrete tanks, and even the deer are herded for royal pleasure. But look across the English Channel, and the beasts are staging a comeback. Brown bear roam Pyrenean ridges, boar saunter through Berlin suburbs, and wolf prints will soon be on North Sea beaches. Mostly, we marvel at our remaining wild fauna from a safe distance. So, imagining this crowded continent filled with even larger creatures is difficult. Far harder is conjuring up entire vanished environments. Most writings about Neanderthals come through an ice-blue tint, their furry compatriots largely pictured as Arctic-adapted creatures. The early discoveries from caves or gravel pits were mainly species such as reindeer or woolly versions of other beasts like mammoth and rhinoceros. The concept of a frozen Neander world took hold, but understanding their authentic experience means deconstructing a simplistic, singular ice age and exploring the many different worlds they lived in, each with its own menagerie. Other, rarer 19th century sites had strange mixes of creatures. At Victoria Cave in Yorkshire, along with hyena, was the hippopotamus and a weird straight-tusked elephant. Not only had Arctic species once lived further south, but tropical creatures had also roamed far up into Europe. Although geologists understood that the deep past encompassed vanished environments, true comprehension of Earth's immense age stole up like a cloud-cast winter dawn. By the 1880s, there was good evidence that the vast expansions of polar ice that scoured much of northern Europe had been dovetailed by interglacial phases as warm as today. It took another century to uncover the true complexity of paleoclimate. Beginning around 3 million years ago, global cycles of cooling and warming ramped up, directed by Earth's eternal waltz around the sun. The details of how planetary elliptical orbit, tilt, and wobble affect our climate are fiendish but predictable. Essentially, the amount of sunlight largely dictates air and sea temperatures. These are the engines driving polar and mountain glacier ice expansion and melt, the effects of which spin out to create climate change. The proof lies in sediments under the ocean and in Greenlandic and Antarctic ice. Cores drilled from deep down contain extraordinarily ancient records of paleoclimate, revealing change in global temperatures over more than 100,000 years at a millennial scale resolution. By dating and comparing them with other, shorter records, pollen sequences in lake beds, dust accumulations blown from ancient tundra, flowstone in caves, or tropical coral reefs, it's possible to finally calibrate paleoclimate over massive spans of time. The pattern is remarkably consistent. The undulating cycles of cooling and warming varied in intensity, and some lasted longer than others, but Earth's heart beats out the same tempo whichever record we look at. The long-term climate cycles have been labelled by researchers using a system known as Marine Isotope Stages, MIS, after the ocean cores. We're living in stage 1, a warm or interglacial period, following stage 2, the last cold phase, which ended around 11.7 thousand years ago. Stage 1 marks the geochronological Holocene boundary. Everything before that, almost 100 cycles until nearly 2 million years ago, is the Pleistocene. Swoop back in time and you can see that warm climate peaks are odd numbers, MIS 3, 5, 7 and onwards, while the cold troughs are even numbers, MIS 2, 4, 6, etc. Even if elements were appearing earlier, distinctively Neanderthal bodies and culture became clearly expressed not during a glacial period, but the Clement MIS-9 interglacial after 350,000 years ago. Moreover, looked at over the full span of time between around 400 to 45,000 years ago, contrary to the clichés, Neanderthals actually lived through more interglacials than glacials. Another important advance in our understanding is that every climate stage was unique. Each contained smaller, shorter temperature wiggles, cold stadials and warm interstadials. These substages are labelled with letters. One that we'll return to below is the first warm pulse during MIS-5, known as 5E. They might last several thousand years, or just a handful of centuries, and changes could be extremely sudden. Drastic transformations in temperature, environment, and even sea level sometimes happened over the span of a human lifetime. All this means that we can reconstruct in quite outstanding detail the conditions in which Neanderthals lived at any point in time, and also what the world was like when they disappeared. This falls around 40,000 years ago in MIS 3, meaning its climate and environments have come under special scrutiny. Despite being classed as an interglacial in its own right, it's really more like an extended warm phase between around 65 and 30,000 years ago, during a longer period of generally colder conditions starting in MIS 4 until the end of MIS 2. In comparison to more ancient true interglacials, MIS 3, for most Neanderthals, was never really toasty. Summers north of the Alps were about equal to those in the Scottish Highlands today, followed by downright soggy autumns. We often envision Neanderthals hunched against bitter snow flurries, but standing in sheeting rain is just as accurate. Winters, though, were definitely colder, with snow probably on the ground for many months. But still, Eurasian MIS 3 environments were far from glacial wastelands. Instead, what makes this climate cycle distinctive is its instability, temperatures seesawing rapidly up and down. Beyond the ice. If Neanderthals squelching around in mud as well as ploughing through snow is unexpected, even bigger surprises exist. The most recent proper interglacial, MIS 5, was even warmer than today. As the preceding MIS 6 glacial ended, temperatures rose rapidly, peaking around 123,000 years ago as the substage MIS 5e, known as the Eemian. The letters go backward, so E is the earliest of five interstadials and stadials in MIS 5. This remains, so far, the warmest period hominins experienced across Eurasia. It lasted roughly 10,000 years, short on geological scales, but equivalent to some 500 generations. So, what was this balmy world like? At least early on, it was sunnier than today. Earth's position relative to the sun was slightly different, bathing the planet in more summer solar radiation. This pushed average temperatures 2 to 4 degrees centigrade higher, with palpable effects. Alpine caves at today's snowline were warm and moist enough to see stalagmites grow, and vast forests spread across the continent. Most dramatically, melting polar caps and glaciers sent sea levels up some 8 metres or 25 feet. As it got hotter and hotter, beaches crept higher, and a kaleidoscope of tree species replaced each other. Pollen records show that birch and pine gave way to oak-rich woodland, speckled by elm, hazel, yew, and linden, eventually maturing into dense hornbeam forest. These lasted until the arrival of spruce, fir, and pine, heralding the start of the succeeding MIS 5D cooler stadial. Neanderthals living at different points in time across this 10,000-year mutating woodland heard very different dawn choruses. Squabbling crossbills and crested tits yielded to crass jays and mellifluous nightingales, until cold mornings saw clattering capercaillies sending breathy vapour into biting air. The Eemian's other fauna also subverts traditional ideas about Neanderthals. Alongside aurochs and horse, who enlarged their diet from grass to browse, were wild boar, roe deer, and their spotted fallow relatives. Beavers feasted on saplings, flooding valleys and creating rich new habitat where turtles swam. In a bizarre ecological shift, these reptiles were hunted by badgers. Other big beasts arrived with the warmth. Water buffalo, straight-tusked elephant and hippopotamus. But one southern climate migrant is especially interesting. Monkeys, specifically Barbary macaques. This species today is confined to isolated parts of North Africa, especially mountain forests. Yet, during the Pleistocene, they were far more widespread and occasionally turn up in earlier and later Neanderthal sites. The shallow cave of Hunas in Germany is probably Eemian and contained macaque remains from the same layer as a Neanderthal tooth and lithic artifacts. These fellow primates must surely sometimes have encountered each other. Barbary macaques are mostly plant eaters, but will take insects and even meat like young birds and rabbits when times are tough. They love to scavenge human trash today, and it's just possible they picked over Neanderthal leavings too. The Eemian sounds like a lush paradise, and though Neanderthals didn't have to worry about frostbite, it wasn't exactly Club Tropicana. Deciduous forests are surprisingly difficult places in which to be a hunter-gatherer, since much of the plant stuff that's edible takes time and energy to make it so. Easily foraged things like nuts and berries tend to be seasonal. Large game was around, but far harder to find in forests. For a long time, the lack of sites led to doubts that Neanderthals had really adapted to the Eemian. But in fact, later erosion probably scrubbed away most sediments of this period. Today, about 30 locales are known, though very few are caves or rock shelters. Mostly, they're preserved in buried lake beds or at carbonate-rich surface springs. In that world, sticking close to water makes sense as the one resource all prey need. Newer research also shows that the Eemian wildwood wasn't a gigantic, unbroken canopy. Two deep lake beds at Neumark Nord, eastern Germany, have stunning preservation, and by sampling every 5 centimetres or 2 inches for tiny plant, insect, and mollusk fragments. Researchers found that the shores were surrounded by mixed vegetation. Alongside light woodland were scrubby hazel thickets and dry, grassy areas with tormentil, mugwort, and daisies underfoot. This harlequin environment attracted a spectrum of animals. Creatures of the forest like boar and straight-tusked elephant, alongside grazers like bison or aurochs. Some herbivores like horse were there too, shuffling between ecological niches. But skeletons and even tracks show all species were drawn to the lakes. How did the Neanderthals fit into this leafy world? The Neumark sequence largely covers the initial hot, drier phase of the Eemian, when dense forest had yet to develop. This period had more diverse animal and plant species, and it's then we find most of the archaeology. Later, as the trees close in, the lake shrunk, prey probably became sparser, and Neanderthals began melting away. They didn't entirely vanish, however. One upper layer formed during a time of dense woodland includes over 120,000 animal bone fragments. It's a uniquely rich record of intense butchery for the Eemian and proves that Neanderthals clung on even as the sunlight was filtered through an ever thicker leaf filigree, and furry flanks became harder to spot behind the great trunks. While Neanderthals were stalking deer at Neumark Nord, westwards across the channel, there seems to have been no one to bother the beasts. Britain actually appears virtually devoid of hominins for 150,000 years, between the end of MIS-7 and the start of MIS-3. A potential window for recolonising would have come just as the deep cold of MIS-6 receded. But a gigantic natural disaster may have literally got in the way. Fed by glacial meltwater from the entire ice cap and swollen by river outflows draining much of Europe, a vast lake formed behind a chalk ridge running across from eastern Britain to France. The soft rock couldn't take the pressure and collapsed, releasing a monstrous flood that ravaged the channel floor. Seismic surveys have uncovered the scars from gargantuan cataracts that bulldozed out massive valleys now buried under sea sediments. So stupendous was the inundation that its closest match is the gorges that slice halfway round Mars. Neanderthals would have heard the unearthly roaring kilometres away, while mammoth herds at far greater distances would have felt infrasound waves rumbling through the ground. Doggerland, the now submerged region between Britain and the continent, was left barren and totally denuded, a wasteland. Deep gorges, treacherous landslides, and vast areas of rock and gravel lay between Neanderthals and the uplands of Britain. This may have been enough to put them off, but it seems that the beginning of MIS5 also saw a rapid rise in sea levels. Britain became cut off before hominin populations had time to reach it. The warm-loving species like elephants and hippo that did make it over may have been those that could safely cross wetland, swollen rivers, and even short stretches of sea. It took another 60,000 years for the climate to cool and sea levels to drop enough so that Doggerland re-emerged at the end of MIS4. As the mammoth steppe environment stretched out once more from the Atlantic to the Pacific, Neanderthals and horses returned to their most northwesterly domains. The only hint that hominin pioneers may have crossed earlier comes from a couple of probable lithics in southeast Britain during a cold phase late in MIS5. However, if they're genuine, sea levels were probably not yet low enough to walk over, so by what means Neanderthals arrived is unclear. Climate crisis. As resolution in paleoclimate and environmental research has increased, it's been discovered that even the Eemian contained brief but drastic climate change. The warmest temperatures and highest sea levels existed for just 4 millennia between 126 and 122,000 years ago, until gradual cooling began. But this was the calm before the storm. What came next is known as the Late Eemian Aridity Pulse, or LEAP, and was a time of crisis. The evidence for LEAP comes from lake sediments inside anciently flooded volcanic craters. Extremely fine annual sediment layers called varves, just 1 millimetre or 0.04 inches thick, accumulated over time. And it's in this muddy archive at about 118.6 thousand years ago that something odd appears. For precisely 468 years, dust rained down. Researchers counted over 50 thick dust pulses, each testament to a landscape plunged into sudden cold and drought. Drastic loss of vegetation led to huge soil erosion and massive dust storms tore through the air. Other sources record this immense climate shock, from flowstones suddenly halted in their growth to pollen cores where warm forests vanish and tundra appears in less than a century. Repeated layers of charcoal are visible. It was so dry, bushfires were igniting. We can only imagine what Neanderthals made of the ravaging of their familiar forests over just a couple of generations, or the frightening and unpredictable weather. The leap ended as fast as it began. Yet, although temperature and humidity rallied briefly and gave time for some warm-loving trees to recolonize, other regions never recovered. Instead, coniferous forests developed, marking the beginning of a temperature decline that would last until the end of the Pleistocene. True tundra took over in northern Europe around 115,000 years ago, and swelling polar ice caps began sending out massive flotillas of icebergs reaching as far south as Iberia. The MIS5 interglacial was on its last legs, gnawed by increasingly rapid, snaggle-toothed successions of warm and cold, tracking its failing pulse. Even so, the Neanderthals kept going. Throughout the last gasps of the interglacial, the number of sites increases and there's growing technological inventiveness. Ice Age. Neither forest, heat, nor dust were enough to do Neanderthals in. But what about the true ice ages during glacials? Their most intense phases had average temperatures of around 5 degrees centigrade lower than today. That was enough for a vast ice front hundreds of meters thick to creep down from the poles. The extent of the ice caps varied during each glacial, but at the peak of MIS6, they came as far as the British Midlands and across to Düsseldorf, Germany. During the last deep freeze of MIS2, even the French southwest, where summer temperatures now reach 40 degrees centigrade, was a land of permafrost and polar desert. As well as the cold, oceans locked up as ice caused tremendous drops in global sea level, sometimes below 100 metres or 30 feet. This created one of the few benefits to glacial living: vast new lands fringed by rich estuaries. Yet, even when ice caps were restrained, times were still extraordinarily harsh. Weather patterns were probably peculiar, with snow and ice storms of a scale that we've never seen. And, as well as frigidity, glacials brought aridity. Biting dry air combined with frozen solid groundwater in permafrost zones made dehydration a real risk. All this caused colossal environmental impacts. Across much of northern Eurasia, pine forests evaporated. Periglacial tundra extended south of the ice cap, forming a variegated carpet of hardy mosses, lichens, and dwarf trees that might reach past ankle height if they tried hard. Southwards, this softened into steppe tundra, resembling parts of Siberia today, but containing a mix of species with no modern analogues. Winds swept a mosaic of aromatic herbs, grasses, and scrub. Verdant green in spring, the land glowed like flame and blood in autumn. Microhabitats existed with lusher vegetation, and pollen and charcoal tell us that some trees clung on. Whippy birches crowded by rivers, and even interglacial stragglers, oak and lime, stowed away in sheltered gorges. Eastwards towards Asia, the steppe was mottled with taiga, boggy coniferous forest, tough to travel through, but favoured by elk. Elk in Europe is what's known as moose in the US. However, we have hardly any evidence Neanderthals hunted them. Even in the more insulated south around the Mediterranean, plant communities changed in response to drier conditions. Neanderthals mostly avoided truly Arctic conditions. For example, in northern France, the rich archaeological record of late MIS5 only really diminishes once harsh, persistent cold in MIS4 kicks in. Some may have moved south, others died out, but the rare MIS4 sites are probably linked to brief, warm spikes in temperature. Woolly rhinoceros and mammoth also left the harshest tundra to Arctic specialists like reindeer or Arctic fox. The most hardcore are musk oxen, adapted for bitter cold and deep snow, and which only expanded southwards during extreme glacials. Fascinatingly, occasional sites where lithics are found along with musk ox bones do exist. They testify that Neanderthals were resilient enough to cope, at least temporarily, with the ultimate in challenging Ice Age environments. But Neanderthals were much happier in steppe tundra, exemplified by MIS3, populated by herds nearly as rich as those in the great African grasslands today. Current, more nuanced understanding of Pleistocene climate and environment certainly casts the hyper-Arctic explanations for Neanderthals' anatomy in an even less certain light. Coast to peak. Neanderthals rode Earth's climate rollercoaster for hundreds of thousands of years, coping with the extremes in weather that went with it. What's more, myth-busting about their world goes beyond temperature to their vast environmental range. They lived far beyond the European regions where they were first discovered and long believed to be their heartlands. Exploring the breadth of their geography shows that though they happily adapted to steppe tundra, in ecological terms, Neanderthals should equally be thought of as creatures of Mediterranean woodland. Peninsulas like southern Italy stayed warm enough for hippo to survive even after MIS5, and as far as we can tell, such landscapes were always a Neanderthal stronghold, right until the end. Let's begin at Europe's southwest tip, Gibraltar. Here, the great rock juts into the Mediterranean, the only place in Europe where wild macaques still clamber on rocks. DNA shows they're not ancient relics, but historic introductions from Algeria and Morocco. North Africa is visible southwards through sea haze. But Pleistocene primates in the form of Neanderthals did live here. Though tiny, just 6 kilometres or 4 miles long, Gibraltar is a rich microcosm of habitats, nurtured by uniquely stable conditions, even during the worst climatic upheavals. Olive groves, geckos, and even tree frogs have survived for many tens of millennia, untroubled by the harsh, arid conditions endured farther north in Iberia. For Neanderthals, this place was prime real estate, abundant, diverse resources, and caves bathed in the rising sun. Humans have always been drawn to the rock. Neolithic and Roman artifacts come from some of the 200-plus caves, though from the 18th century, use of this hulking mass of stone became more intense. Today, military fortifications jostle for space with a cable car and the nature reserve where macaques hassle tourists for snacks. But beneath all this, tunnels 10 times longer than the entire promontory honeycomb the limestone. Military digging began in the 1700s, eventually leading to the discovery of the Forbes skull, and much later, the First World War stationing of Dorothy Garrett's mentor, prehistorian Henri Breuil, set in motion her finding of the Devil's Tower Child. But it wasn't until the 1980s that the large caves further along the cliffs were investigated, revealing what life on Costa del Neanderthal was like. Only during high sea levels like today does the dawn light scatter off the Mediterranean into the lofty Vanguard and Gorham's caves. But the ocean has always been important to Neanderthals living here. When the shore was closer, they collected seafood and made the most of rarer, bigger finds like fish or marine mammals. During glacials, the coast retreated up to 5 kilometres or 3 miles away, exposing a dry dune plain in front of the caves. But even then, Neanderthals brought back shellfish, including large mussels gleaned from rocky estuaries a considerable walk to the east. As we'll hear in Chapter 8, the few sites where we see Neanderthals as coastal foragers on both the Atlantic and Mediterranean seaboards are probably the tip of the iceberg. Many hundreds more would have been flooded by rising oceans. There must be drowned caves whose current tenants in the form of crabs and suspicious moray eels are matched by buried seafood remains. Submarine archaeological surveys are now beginning to search Europe's rocky margins, but already we must rethink Neanderthal feet as not only striding across steppe, but leaving prints on sandy strands. The beach now in front of the Gibraltar caves is mixed with fine blasting debris from military tunnelling that included creating vast water tanks for the Second World War garrison. Supplies for the town remain a concern, and infrastructure works in the 1980s, more than 250 metres, 650 feet up the cliffs, uncovered a small cavity. A stop-off for Neanderthals hunting high up on this mini-montane environment, their main quarry were ibex, relatives of goats, but a lot bigger. Their remains gave the site its name, Ibex Cave. Yet, it seems Neanderthals were here not to stay or even butcher carcasses, since there are very few lithics. Instead, the main attraction may have been the expansive views of the plain below. They took what ibex they caught back down to Gorham's and Vanguard caves, perhaps sliding down an enormous dune of wind-blown sands that banked up against the cliff. A good shortcut when hefting weighty haunches of meat. Ibex are found at dozens of other Neanderthal sites in craggy environments. Nimble, cocky, and extremely strong, they must have required particular hunting techniques and special care to avoid the enormous curving horns. Perhaps even harder to catch were chamois, but we find them too, including some 1,400 metres or 4,600 feet up at Las Callejuelas, west central Spain. It's cold and very dry even today, but what about even higher altitudes? No problem. Neanderthals in the Alps, Carpathians, and other mountain ranges were climbing at least up to 2,000 metres or 6,500 feet. Outside full interglacials, these lofty landscapes must have been marked by swollen glaciers and snowy slopes for most of the year. Why did they choose such extreme places? Following species like red deer that seasonally move to high grazing is one possibility. But mountains themselves may have been attractive, offering abundant, high-quality stone, a resource Neanderthals must have been constantly alert for. They may even have traced the sources of river cobbles upstream, as later prehistoric peoples did. Other mountain specialities might have been on the menu, such as hibernating bears. But elsewhere, it seems that Neanderthals were active up at impressive elevations because they were simply comfortable there. Noisetier Cave in the French Pyrenees is over 800 metres or 2,600 feet elevation and has no obvious montane resources that might have attracted Neanderthals there between 100 and 60,000 years ago. The red deer and mountain sheep they were hunting were also common at lower altitudes, and neither is there any particularly good stone nearby. Instead, this looks just like many other caves across their world, regularly, if briefly used, as a place to stay. Either Neanderthals here were permanent mountain dwellers, or were using it as a stop en route to other regions. If that's the case, we're looking at crossing the Pyrenees. That's backed up by lithic sourcing studies proving Neanderthals undertook such journeys over high passes in the Pyrenees, the Massif Central, and other mountain ranges. Whether they were up among spindrift-shrouded peaks or searching among seaweed, there appear to be few landscapes that really put Neanderthals off. Even deserts feature on the great map of their realm. The complete opposite of what we'd expect for Arctic specialists. The warm, rocky Mediterranean ecology that stretched between Gibraltar and Turkey eventually transforms into even drier environments towards Central Asia, all of which are rich in Neanderthal fossils and archaeology. Ecologically, they could shift gear, adapting to whatever was on offer, from palm dates to olives, tortoise to gazelle, even, on the fringes of Arabia, giant camels. The only sort of country in Western Eurasia lacking evidence so far for Neanderthals is true wetlands. To do more than briefly visit such places, serious investment in either watercraft or raised structures like trackways and platforms is needed. But never say never. Perhaps somewhere a surprise waits in northern peats deep below the sleeping moss-tanned bog bodies of the Iron Age. Visions of Neanderthals struggling through deep snow, breath puffing in frozen air, have been remarkably persistent since their discovery. Yet, our Ice Age blinkers have concealed their innate adaptability. Polar desert was never their true home, although in extremis they may have coped for a while. Mostly, they avoided extreme cold and appear to have been most successful in more temperate climes, whether surrounded by grassy plains or wooded glades. Even cold-adapted animals, such as woolly mammoths, were ecologically malleable, originating during the MIS6 glacial, but found later alongside warm-loving, straight-tusked forest elephants. It's our own pigeonholing tendencies that limit Neanderthals to glacial worlds, when the reality is far more diverse. But they had something other creatures didn't, allowing them to cope with all but the worst the Pleistocene could throw at them, a complex technological culture.